Queer Rights Sessions, QWS podcast in partnership with Blarney Books and Art in Port Ferry. I'm your host, Rob, aka RWR McDonald.
And I'm Jonathan Butler, and this is a Words and Nerds spin-off series.
Thanks, Danny. We're coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people, and I would like to pay my respects to their elders past and present.
Each month, QWS podcast will bring you reviews,
shout-outs of LGBTQIA+ writers,
and feature an interview with a queer writer from our rainbow communities.
And now on with the show.
Hello, my name is Jonathan Butler. My pronouns are he, him, and as a proud queer history nerd myself, I am beyond excited to introduce Fiona Kelly McGregor to the Queer Rights Sessions podcast. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Hi, Jonathan. I'm beaming in from Gadigal country, and it's a great pleasure to be here.
Fiona is a multidisciplinary writer, artist, and critic who has published 8 books. Her most recent was Iris, published by Picador Pan Macmillan in 2022, and was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award, the ALS Gold Medal, the New South Wales Premier Award, the ARA Historical Novel Prize, and longlisted for the Stella Prize, the Voss Literary Award, the Book People, and the ABDA Awards. Fiona is also the author of the photo essay, A Novel Idea, and the essay collection, which spans almost 3 decades of Fiona's writing, and that one's called Buried Not Dead, which was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. Her novel, Indelible Ink, won the Age Book of the Year in 2011, and when in Sydney, Fiona lives and works on Gadigal land. Now, we open all our interviews with a very broad question, which is, how has your work influenced your identity?
I don't know. I mean, I've been writing and publishing since I was about 19, and I've been queer since I was 23, so it's definitely changed it. I would say that it's given me greater insight into a lot of things, because once you're pushed to the margins, you can see how the centre operates with a critical distance, and you are treated in a really different way as well. And I think the best thing that you can do with that is develop empathy and insight into how all marginalised groups are treated, really. And, you know, that's what happens to women in general. And all of those things change throughout time as well. So, yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting to that a little bit more throughout our discussion. I did want to kick off with talking about Iris. So Iris, for those who don't know, is based on the life of petty criminal and busker Iris Webber and set in 1932 to 1937 in inner Sydney slums. It's epic and picaresque. Iris is a teeming social portrait of schemers, gamblers, good time girls, gangsters, sly groggers, and queer star-crossed lovers. So history is often discovered through material evidence of what's left behind and what's survived for whatever reason. So diaries and legal documents, photographs, relics, and other artifacts. But the streets and buildings that we pass every day are also a kind of archive in themselves, even when they may no longer be recognisable. I listened to your lecture that you did with ASAL last week, and it really struck me how intimately you were familiar with every single alleyway of the few blocks of Surry Hills that Iris lived and worked. Why do you think that place is so important to history, and what can we learn from reading about stories of specific places like Iris's home, workplaces, busking spots, and favourite watering holes, etc.?
Well, in Sydney, Sydney is really self-destructive and has erased a lot of its places, much more than Melbourne, which is a much better preserved city. And so the need to remember, or even just to excavate those old places, is even more urgent. And the places tell us a lot about how people lived. And, you know, architecture is also a form that preserves hierarchies. And so you can see, you know, literally what kind of tiny little hovels the characters in Iris lived in as compared to, say, the grand mansions of Frank Packer, the media mogul in Bellevue Hill. You know, that's the built environment, but also the natural environment is in Sydney is really important, I think, to the character of the city and to the people. And probably today, nature is much more prevalent in the inner city because of gentrification. So in Iris's day, there wasn't a lot of vegetation. Surry Hills was a factory district. And, you know, that's another thing about what happens to those old industrial spaces. Sometimes they're torn down, but sometimes they're rejuvenated in a good way, and sometimes they're just, you know, turned into luxury apartments. So all of those things play into why it's important to know, and it really enriches your experience of living in a place. And I think once you know more, you also can undertake to be a better cultural custodian. And in a way, we all need to be that when we're living somewhere, no matter where we're living. So I think it's important for just so many reasons, yeah.
Is there much left of Iris's time when you walk around the streets of Surry Hills today?
Well, no, the actual neighbourhood, you know, she sort of walks up the hill to Kate Lee's first beer house and then around to over to Devonshire Street. She sort of circulates around an area that's maybe 20 minutes or half an hour's walk in a circle. And that's actually all gone because it was considered the worst slum in Australia after Frog Hollow, which was at the other end of Surry Hills, which had already been razed. And it was a place that Ruth Park lived quite close to and observed in her books and lobbied very strongly for the first housing commissions to be built. And they were literally right above Iris's house. Plisdale Street is the street she lived on, and it's this very steep dip of a street that comes down from the Belvoir Street Theatre that some people might know if they've anyone who's been to Sydney. And Plisdale Street is now a split-level street, and from the top of it, right up over the hill, are the very first housing commissions, starting with red brick 1950s blocks and then the towers called Northcote further up, which, you know, became a bit notorious later as places of crime. But, of course, that's a very simplistic, sensationalist view. They've actually got three or four generations of people living in there now, and vegetable gardens and communities and, you know. I don't know how much longer they're going to last, so I think the developers will probably get them.
Right. So I imagine it was really important to sort of find older maps and photographs so you could sort of reimagine what Iris would have seen and experienced.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Devonshire Street itself has some of the original dwellings. There's in the book, there's a place called Sadie Pin's Grocery Store, and Sadie Pin was a notorious fence. And she's brought to life briefly, and that building is still there. And across the road from her is a house that in which one of the gangsters, Bill Smilly, was born and lived his whole life, and that's still there. It's very zhuzhy, million-dollar Surry Hills terrace house now. Different from what it once would have been. Yeah, and they're still there. Yeah, and then further up, there's a place which Kate Lee came over to. Kate Lee was the sly grog queen of Sydney, for listeners who aren't familiar. And she came over to that place later on, probably from the mid to late 40s onwards. And that place is still there as well.
Amazing. I'll have to do the Iris Webber walking tour of Surry Hills one day when I'm up in Sydney next. The historical archive also has its limitations, however. For a long time, it's favoured the rich, unless, of course, you're talking about court documents of over-policed communities. So it can sometimes be difficult representing the nuance of maybe working class and other marginalised populations. You've done such an amazing job, though, bringing aspects of queer history to life, you know, with Iris, with the love story, as well as different venues. Can you give us insight into how you tackled these gaps in the archive and still managed to tell such a believable sort of vivid story?
Well, oral history is really important, and it began, I mean, I'm not a historian, obviously, but the sort of the really big blossoming of it, I think, was probably in the 70s, and it entered into an acceptable form of history into the academic institutions. And that's when you get fantastic working class histories, sex worker history, gay histories, and of course, Aboriginal histories, but it's, you know, tens of thousands of years old for them. So they're the leaders in this, in many ways. And those sources are really important. And even if I was, I access those sources, and you also hear the accents in which people speak and the vocabulary that they use. And most, if not all, of the more conventional histories that have been written about this time have accessed those oral histories as a central source. So that's probably the most important thing. And fiction and literature from the time is important. I think that, we read 19th century novels to understand the conditions of working class people back then, and fiction gives us an insight into how the inner and outer worlds connect, which history doesn't, because history has limitations. The imagination is limited in a different way in the writing of history. So fiction, I think, is really important. Poetry, any kind of, lyrical form, really. Song, popular songs are important as well.
You mentioned the limitations of imagination. What do you mean by that when it comes to history specifically?
Because you have to prove things when you're writing conventional history. You have to provide your sources and your citations. You can't just imagine how someone felt and what went on in their private relationships. However, the way that they felt and what went on in their private relationships is obviously a really important part of human history and how we lived. So that's where the novel comes in as a form, which is good to bring it all together in. And I suppose the gaps in the record, like, obviously affect queer people enormously, because we were outlawed. And so queer lives were taking place, in a fugitive way, and the recording of them was completely disallowed in history because they were so morally reprehensible, but also you had to hide to survive. So to excavate queer history, there's a lot of really great Australian historians, queer historians like Ruth Ford, Lucy Chesser, Gary Wotherspoon, Clive Farrow, and I read all of the material available, and they're also really good writers, those historians. They're not just inaccessible academic writers. They're really important. And so I'm indebted to them. And, they've excavated our history, looking at things like, going to the police gazettes and criminal records, but also going to things like letters and oral histories, once again.
Quite remarkable about Iris, the real figure, was that there is, quite a lot of evidence to suggest that she did have sort of same-sex desires and relationships. I know that it can be complicated to add our labels of today onto the past, but we're pretty confident that she was and was treated pretty poorly because of it. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. My exegesis is online if anyone is interested in finding out more about that. I probably don't have the time to go into all the factual proof of that, but it's there. And again, it is kind of an ambivalent place for a woman because, of course, homosexuality was only decreed to take place between men because women weren't sexual protagonists at all, apparently. But, yeah, there's enough proof there. I mean, I don't know how to explain it in a soundbite, except one thing I can say is that I went through pretty much every police gazette from the 1920s to the 1940s, and it before a bigger embargo came down to restrict that. And there were more arrests for male homosexual activity than there were for gathering arms. And gathering arms is the most common charge that Iris received, because she made her living by playing the accordion in the streets. And it's really clear that she's being pursued, not really just for playing that accordion, but for a lot of other stuff. And she was very outspoken. So
The voice of Iris is so rich, and I understand you did a huge amount of research, not just on the times and the places that we've been talking about, but also the slang and the language, and you wanted to make sure that felt pretty accurate. Now, this is a technical question. We have a lot of writers that listen to the podcast. How did you balance your own voice as a writer with the voice that Iris would have spoken and thought about herself?
Well, I think that's probably one of those kind of magical things that happens that you have to kind of close your eyes and stop thinking too hard when you're writing a novel and just let it out. And it does take me back to the importance of fiction and literature. So part of the, what should I say, the ingredients to her voice came from that wide array of fiction that, you know, that I mentioned in the lecture last week: Ruth Park, Christina Stead, Kylie Tennant, Louis Stone, Dinfna Cusack, Florence James, those early 20th century Australian writers who concentrated, focused on the lives of the working people and of women, were places that I went to. Darcy Nyland as well, and there are some nonfiction books. And what you notice is that there is a spoken voice that comes through, but it's actually incredibly various. Every one of those writers spells the vernacular differently, and every one of those writers puts different idioms on the page. And I think that just by absorbing all of the variety of those sources over the years, I eventually produced, you know, a voice that's unique to the book. But I didn't actually set out to write in her voice. Like, I wrote the first three drafts third person, and it wasn't really working, and I couldn't figure out why. And then as I launched into the fourth draft, the voice came out, and it was a real breakthrough. And I think it was, you know, kind of I'd absorbed all those sources by then and could write quite naturally in Iris's voice. So I don't make any claims to authenticity. I mean, it's kind of impossible, but it's probably as close as I could have gotten. Although I do have to say that, you know, like, this book is narrated by this, you know, working class, crim, queer woman, and in, you know, in the 1930s. And those times were so sexist and racist and homophobic. And that means that's in everybody's language and thoughts. You don't have a special magical, you know, bigotry-proof door between you and the world. And I had to be really careful with that language, and I had to really filter or sort of tread a line between keeping enough brutality to get that world across and not whitewash it. It's really important not to sanitize it, but also to not dump a whole bunch of toxic retrograde stuff on a reader that's much more sophisticated now.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about, because obviously there is a lot of intense language and a lot of violence. And I know that you have spoken before about how important it is that we are brave when it comes to telling stories from the past and using language from the past. And that can certainly come with its own challenges. Do you have any advice for other writers out there who might be challenged with this problem of, you know, I know from my own research, you know, the most common word was pervert to describe, you know, any sort of sexual deviancy. And, you know, those sort of words might be really offensive today and people might be avoid using it. But I'd be keen to get your thoughts on this challenge that we face as writers.
Yeah. Pervert was used for bestiarists and rapists and pedophiles and lesbians and gay men, all in a nice happy family. But also, I think that at this point it's kind of helpful that I came of age in the 80s and 90s, because, you know, we used to wear, well, I didn't personally, but there'd always be someone in a little micro T saying pervert, or, you know, fag or dyke or poof. And, you know, that was the period of reclamation of pejoratives. And so I guess you kind of take it for granted when you're living through that. And I've been quite surprised to find myself over the last 5 or 10 years amongst younger people who flinch at, queer people, younger queer people who flinch at that language. And you can back off because you don't want to hurt people or traumatize people. But also, I think it's probably better to explain and educate and dispel the fear, because that's what the whole point was in the beginning. It was about dispelling fear. That's what reclamation is. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that the word queer, which has become the big happy word now, and it's a good word, it's inclusive, and it's a word that doesn't interfere historiographically, which is useful for me because there are a lot of words, 21st century terminology, that would not be appropriate for Iris in her world, but queer works. But the word queer first appeared in Australia in 1942 in a trial of an American serviceman who king hit a female impersonator, and they can hear my language is from the times, a female impersonator in a nightclub called Siegfeld's. And Harry Foy, he actually worked at a pub up the road from me in the day, and then at night he donned women's clothes and was a famous entertainer in the city, and he died. And this guy, this American serviceman in his trial, said he was a queer, and it had to be explained in the court. This word had to be explained. It was American, and it was only for men, for, you know, again, for those perverted kinds of men who dressed up in women's clothing. So, you know, so we use that word now, but it was a terrible, terrible word a few decades ago, just as bad as the words dyke and poof. And yeah, it's kind of interesting. So looking at the long view of language is really good to keep in mind. If I can sort of get back to advice for the younger writer, keep the long view in mind and how organic it is and how it means different things to different people at different times and in different cultures. And we are very, very influenced by American language in ways that are kind, I think, a little bit kind of limiting. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Also, write in a way that is true to the context. So if that means it's a particular era or it's a particular character, stick to the way that they speak. And another thing that's important is to consult people and be sensitive, but don't be afraid. That's probably the best advice I could give.
Something I think I've heard you say before as well is the squeamishness that we can feel about this language can also be related to the squeamish that we have about bodies and sex, which ironically can also lead to more homophobia. So it's actually, that was quite inspiring to me to sort of actually, it's a good thing to sort of be brave and sort of tell the truth.
Yeah, I use that term because, you know, this we're in this time of reckoning and things are changing really dynamically. And I think the way to keep them as constructive change is to not be, to try to avoid being puritanical and punitive about this. If we look at language that is offensive, and, you know, we're queer people, we're inside of that situation. And, you know, I'm assuming that there are, my heritage is Irish, Celtic, but I'm sure that there are non-white people listening here who are even much more worsely affected than me. But being puritanical and punitive, I think what I was saying in that lecture is that it takes us dangerously close to this kind of, white sort of puritanism, which is the same sort of puritanism that prevented us from writing about sex and the body or anything that was considered morally disgusting. And so I guess that goes back to what I meant about being sensitive but not being afraid, be true to the context. I've had to write little notes at the beginning of my last two books for this reason. You can use that as a way to keep language in your work that might be offensive. But sometimes those notes can be, they can be a bit sort of overdetermined and patronising. So, yeah, it's a bit of a, you do have to spend some time thinking about it, and it'll be different for every bit of writing, I'm sure. And it'll be different in 3 years from now as to what it was 5 years ago.
I also love how you approach your narrative structure of Iris. There's a number of locations, you know, there is scenes in the bush as well as the city, a large volume of characters and a very specific timeline. It's 5 years, things happen before and after that. But I was never confused, and that is saying a lot.
Thank you.
So I'd love to know what the process was like of plotting and planning Iris. And you said earlier that it was written initially in third person to first person, and I imagine that would have had some repercussions from the plot and as well.
Yeah, I decided very early on that I wanted to concentrate on the years 1932 to 37 because they were the years in which Iris was involved in the most violent crimes of her life, as far as all of the records have told me. And also they were the years in which she left her husband and came to Sydney, and the years in which she developed a profile as a criminal. And so I wanted to look at all of those events and figure out, you know, how she became the person that she became. So then the question of how to structure that was really, that doesn't answer the problem of structure and plot. And I kind of had to do a crash course in those things because they were never my strengths as a writer. And, you know, you can be a novelist your whole life and not be particularly good at those things, but I wanted to be. And so I got some really great feedback from Matilda Imlar, who was the publisher at Picador, who signed the book, even though by the time it was published, she'd gone. So she's credited as a really important sounding board for that. And the change in the voice also left me with the opportunity to use the third person as a kind of way to pin down that the storytelling of Iris. I guess there are really salient events that I was interested in. But also what happens when you're writing a novel is that because you're building, I mean, novels are really driven by emotional relationships, and building them requires spending a lot of time in areas that you have no record for whatsoever, you know, the love affair, and stitching those completely imagined circumstances with the public record. And I used the first person, you know, Iris's first person, to really put down most of that. And the third person is, they're like tent poles that hold it all down, and they all pertain to the law and to authority, to the courts or the prison cells or the jail. And they also give me an opportunity to slip into the heads of some of those figures of authority and look at the way that they looked at Iris, to give us an idea of how she was viewed and what she was up against, really. Yeah.
You're a performance artist, musician, critic, and writer, and I'm really fascinated about the different opportunities and limitations of each of these forms, both from a creative expression point of view, but also audience expectations and the industry machine that sort of drives each of these mediums, and it's quite different art forms. So at this point of your career, do you have a favourite?
Yeah, I don't. I stopped playing music a long time ago, and then I did performance later, and I haven't actually done performance for some time either. And I don't want to shut the door on it altogether, but I might not do any more performance art again. I'm not sure. So yeah, I've been really focused on writing for the last 5 years, I suppose. Finishing Iris really brought me into it completely. And because I also teach and review, there's not much time left. And I'm also really, developing as an essayist and a novelist and a critic requires a lot of time. So I'm probably just writing these days without the other art forms. But I've got, you know, having done those other art forms has been a really good training ground for me.
And was that quite organic? Was sort of which sort of thing you pursued, or was it quite planned in that, you know, you really sort of want to move into writing now?
No, I'd say it was very organic. Like I started playing music when I was a teenager, and I think that was just a classic teenage escape thing. Music's such an exciting medium. And there was a really big band scene in Sydney back then, so there were opportunities to actually go out and learn and have fun at the same time and access this really great culture. And then I think it laid a really good groundwork for me to appreciate dance party culture in a deeper way, because the music is so important and the music contains so much of the politics. And so it kind of led to that. And the writing kind of happened probably just because I grew up reading a lot, and I didn't really study at university. Like, I dropped out, but I kept doing that. And it's the one, and I actually came and went from it. Like, I did walk away from it after my first two books for a while. And then I went back to it with Chemical Palace. Yeah.
I have a quote from Bury Not Dead that's related to what we're talking about. And it's when you talk about the Auslit scene and queerness. So it's, I'd published two books, yet my main creative focus was, again, music, now dance and electronica. It was largely due to the bourgeois cloister that Auslit was in those days. To be queer was to be marked. With these people, I felt at home. I had found my new Pied Pipers. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, I guess, Auslit scene today and being a queer writer. And do you think that's changed at all?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's much easier, and it's also, I think, predicated by a consciousness across the culture generally that we do need to be better at this. We've actually got anti-discrimination legislation, you know, that's keeping, that we didn't have, you know, when I started out. There's a lot of box ticking that still goes on and tokenism, but I think that that's better than nothing. And I think that every single time there is a gig or a program that's being built, every single one of those curators and admin people has the opportunity to go beyond the box with their imagination. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't, I guess. I think that, you know, it's funny going back to that remark about writing about sex and bodies, is that, I mean, there are so many different ways to be queer now, and so many different books and topics that are covered. And I do think that when we come back to sex and sexuality and some kind of fringe political position, which is predicated by that, and gender nonconformity, then that takes you further away from mainstream opportunities. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the gender revolution's really, there's been, you know, six or seven or more significant trans nonfiction books I've read, you know, like, well, unless there's ones I haven't read, I think, well, I've read nearly all of them. Really amazing how that is going in leaps and bounds. Sometimes there are essay collections like Sam Elkin's forthcoming Detachable Penis, or memoirs like Kaya Wilson's work. Quinn Eads is a really great pioneer in that space. And that has, you know, it's accelerates the understanding of the general public enormously. And you can see, looking at Sam's work, how much more he could say than Quinn could say only 10 years ago. And every single one of them is a brave writer. And every single time we write about queerness or gender or something, trying to break new ground is a risk, but it does open things out a little bit more. So, you know, it's like, I mean, Christos Tsolkas is a really interesting person to look at, as how incredibly successful he is. And I think that if you analyze that, you'll see that the most successful books are the ones that are the least sort of, have the least gay sex in them.
That's a shame.
I think he's a fantastic writer. This is not, I'm not doing an assessment, a quality assessment. It's really like a content thing. And he's also really prolific, and he's had really great film and TV adaptations, and that brings people to his work. And I think, you know, there are, that's one of the reasons why he's managed to break through, rather than because he writes such fantastic, detailed, abject gay sex. But that's not why he's become so successful. He's managed to do that in spite of that. That's what I think personally. But I would say to everyone out there, please be brave, because we need it. Yeah, generally as a culture. And I say that to myself.
I'm so glad I asked you that. That was fascinating. Thank you, Fiona. So we've reached the closing questions of our chat. And the first one is, what was your hope for Iris when it came out into the world?
Oh, God. I guess, you know, you just, every novelist wants their work to be widely read and to be published internationally and win the prizes. You know, you always shoot for the stars, and you never, well, some people make them, but you know, Iris didn't make it. But I think that, well, I was just thinking today about how one of the motivations I had was I wanted to dispel the myths about her. She'd been really villainized, and she'd had this epithet, the most violent woman in Sydney, and the only person who'd written about her in any level of detail had written about her to damn her in this sort of tabloid biography of a policewoman, Lillian Armfield. So Iris was kind of used as a tool to really damn lesbianism. It's a 7-page chapter, and three pages from that chapter are a fulmination of it against lesbianism. It's rabid. And so that material is the descriptors that went on to museum plaques when she was later revived, and it was really pernicious, and I wanted to dispel, that was one of my motivations, and I reckon that worked. And in general, that period has really persisted in Sydney, again, in a tabloid form. People always go razor gangs, razor hearst. And even at the time, that was a media beat up. So I wanted to also get into more detail and more background of how those people lived and what really happened. I don't know if that worked, because I think that, you know, Razorhurst prevails and in the popular imagination, and I think that people are probably more excited by that. I don't know. So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know from being inside the book. I think it's really nice to always love hearing from readers, and, you know, that's really wonderful. That's really great. That really makes it worthwhile. Yeah.
Mm. You've been very generous already with advice, but we do ask a very general writing question, which is, do you have any advice or top tips for aspiring writers or storytellers that are listening today?
I say reading. Reading is the most important thing. Read as much as you can, and don't have high expectations, because you won't survive, because it's a tough business. It's a difficult business. It's really painful. It really... yeah, and it's not a fair business either. So you need to just sort of learn to deal with all of that if you want to survive. And if you can get friends around you who read, that's a really useful thing. I had a lot of periods in my life where I didn't, and I look back and I think it might have been better if I had. And read widely as well, yeah, as widely as you can.
We now have an opportunity for any shout outs that you'd like to give. So firstly, how would you recommend anyone who's listening who'd like to keep in contact with you and your future projects? Is there any way to connect with you on socials or events or that sort of thing?
I think I've got a public page on Facebook, but I think I probably post more on Instagram, because it's a visual medium, and then I can post art that I write about or see. And if I've got something in more detail, I've actually just started to put a little blog up on my website. It's not very sophisticated. I've got to do some work on that this year. So, yeah, I would say I don't have a Twitter account. I've just got probably Instagram, and my website would be the best place.
And your Instagram handle, do you have that?
Yeah, it's just my name, Fiona Kelly McGregor.
Nice, nice and easy. And the second shout out is, would you like to mention any LGBTQIA plus artists, books, shows, organisations, social media accounts, anything you like?
I will mention Sam Elkin, Sophie Cunningham, Christos Tsolkas, Jen Mills. I think they're all really great Australian queer writers. Kane Race is an academic, but he writes really great stuff. And I'm sure there are more that I'll think of. There are some that I mentioned earlier too, like Kaya Wilson and yeah. Okay, I'd also recommend people read and look at the social media account of Lisa Salmon, who's the founder of Wicked Women and has just returned to Australia and is starting to write about those days, and it's fascinating stuff. I think Jay Carmichael did a really beautiful job with his novel set in the 1940s about gay men in Melbourne. Yeah, and so spare and so understated. Yeah, great book.
So the closing question that we have is, and it's another broad one, it's what is your hope for the LGBTIQ plus communities?
Keep growing. I think that one of the most important things for us to do is to maintain and, in fact, improve our international relationships and help people outside of this country that are struggling so much. And that might take any number of different forms. I mean, just awareness, lobbying. Also, maybe what we need to work on is immigration and refugee policies and corridors for people to come in. I don't think it's easy. I've got a number of friends actually who live here from difficult countries and like Indonesia, and it's really arduous. So I think keep your eye on supporting how to support those people. Definitely.
Wonderful. Well, that's the end of our chat today. Thank you so much, Fiona. This has been really fascinating, and I'm excited to listen back to this and take note of all those amazing insights and tips that you had and things to read. So thank you again for your time.
Okay, thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Please check out our show notes on Words and Nerds, Blarney Books and Art, and rwrmcdonald.com for links, reviews, and the interview transcript. Until next time, this is QWS Podcast.